Hi, this is Steve from The Cinephiles. In our next episode, we welcome writer, producer, executive, and My Little Pony guru, Michael Vogel, to discuss the 1978 Richard Donner film, Superman, starring Christopher Reeve. Now, this is a big one. I mean, today, superhero movies come out all the time, but this was the very first one, the first mainstream, big-budget comic book adaptation, and Christopher Reeve's Superman, well, that's always going to be the gold standard for me. Unlike our last movie, When We Were Kings, you can get Superman just about anywhere. You can rent it on iTunes, Amazon, Google Play. There's a really good Blu-ray edition with lots of special features. And I think you can even watch a free version with ads on YouTube. So check out Superman and look for the next episode of The Cinephiles on Friday. Who knows, we might even spend a few minutes talking about the latest screen versions of the Big Blue Boy Scout. Okay, maybe more than a few minutes. See you then. Hello and welcome once again to The Cinephiles, where each week we enter the world of a classic film and explore its themes, history, the filmmaking, and the influence it has on films today. My name is Steve Morris. I'm a filmmaker and directing teacher in Los Angeles, California.
Hey, I'm John Rocha. I'm an actor and VO artist here in Los Angeles, California. And host of shows.
Of a myriad of podcasts.
Yes.
And today, for the first time on The Cinephiles, we have a very special guest, our first guest. Mike Vogel is an animation executive and expert who started at Sony TV Animation, where he developed Spider-Man, moved on to Hasbro, where he oversaw such properties as The Transformers, G.I. Joe, and of course, the unbelievably and wildly successful My Little Pony, which he's also been a producer and a writer for. Mike, welcome to The Cinephiles.
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here with you boys.
and from what I understand, this is your first podcast.
Yeah, this is my first time actually doing a podcast. Long-time listener, first-time podcaster? Is that the way I should say it?
Are you in fact a long-time listener?
No.
So you've begun your first podcast with a lie.
God, you know, this is really getting off to a terrible start,
this
guys.
This is a tough show.
Especially since we're talking about Superman today. I feel like I really just got off on the wrong foot by not being honest.
So Mike has now buried the lead on our film this today is?
It's Superman.
Yes.
The original Christopher Reeve Superman. And when we originally talked, we knew we wanted to have Mike on the show.
Yeah.
And we were originally talking about doing an animation feature, which obviously he's an expert on, and there's no question that we're going to do that in the future. Mm-hmm. But as we started thinking about it, we thought, knowing Mike, that the original Superman would be a great choice. And I wanted to ask you, what's your personal relationship to the character of Superman?
I think that it's actually really funny. A lot of people know me as sort of a comic book guy, but growing up, I wasn't really a comic book guy. I was more into animation. It wasn't until kind of college where I kind of dove into comic books and kind of did the same thing everybody did. You know, you kind of get enamored of Batman, you get really into X-Men, you know, there's all of the Marvel universe and all the struggles, and you kind of overlook Superman because he seems kind of like your dad's superhero. He's kind of classic and goofy and he's a Boy Scout. But once I actually started reading some Superman comics, I realized that I don't want to say I related to him because it makes me think that I think very highly of myself, but I kind of realized that there was something about him that I was really drawn to, and he kind of became my favorite of all the superheroes, which is a constant argument that you get into when people ask, why is Superman your favorite? And I think why I wanted to come on today and talk about the movie is I think that the reason that the original Superman is so lasting and is such a hard act to follow with any other post-Superman films is because of the stuff that I like about him.
Yeah.
That's right. John, how did you come to the first Superman movie?
My parents took me to see it in the theater. I remember seeing it and just being completely in love with the film. Because at that age, you know, when you're a child, I was like, I don't know, I was like 10, 8 or 9, 10, something like that. Whenever they took me, you're just lost in the joy of the film. And it hit at the perfect age where I could be like, as a child, I want to be that. I want to fly like that. I want to have a romance. Like, oh, this romance. Like, even the romance, I remember being like, wow, this is so amazing. All of it.
I don't know about that.
Yeah. Okay. There is such a
by the way, if this were video, you would see the shocked look on Mike Vogel's face right now.
You don't know about the romance? We'll get into that in a minute.
Well, there was the magic of the film, too, because his outfit has these bright colors. And even the beginning, you have this sense of the feeling of being outside of the norm, outside of the mainstream. He's picked on by the cooler kids, at, you know, with the football stuff in high school. I always felt that way, even as a child, being a Latino child in a predominantly white area where I was at the time, being heavier than everyone else, having a bowl haircut. Like, it just, for me, there was a lot of things that made me feel like an outsider. And to see him succeeding in that way, you're like, that's what I would like to be. That's what I aspire to be. And they didn't make it in a way that was, they didn't present him in a way that was untouchable or unattainable, which I loved.
And were you a comic book guy before seeing Superman?
Not before seeing Superman. I guess I'd read him. I'd read stuff in the papers, mm-hmm. you know, or you'd get that occasional comic where my dad or my mom might buy something for 5 or 10 cents back then, and you know, like, oh, read this. So I knew about him, but I wasn't any kind of collector. Not until I hit 15 or 16 when I started collecting seriously.
And Mike, do you remember when you first saw it?
I saw Superman when I was a kid, but I saw it so young that I think the only thing I remember is that Gene Hackman had a toupee. I mean, I think that was really the only thing I really took away from it. And, you know, kind of like some of the best superhero stories in general, you know, you kind of come back to it when you're a little bit older. And you remember, I mean, to John's point, yeah, you remember Superman's costume. You remember Christopher Reeve. You remember those iconic things. But you come back and watch it when you're a little bit older, and it's sort of like a treasure trove of things that you didn't get when you were a kid and kind of deeper meaning. And I think that, you know, as we all kind of go on this journey of life and you're figuring things out, when you're a kid, you're like, that's awesome. I want to fly.
Yeah.
When you get older and you're dealing with older person issues that you deal with in your life, you start to understand what the superhero mythos is really about, right. And that the flying and the tights and the capes are cool, but that there's an underlying sort of a morality and kind of ethical code and kind of different things that you start to draw from. At least I do. Like that really is the reason that Superman resonates with me so much.
Absolutely. It's interesting, which I hadn't thought about, but all three of us came to this very differently. Because for me, my dad, when he was a kid, collected Superman and Batman comics. So that's super late 40s, early 50s. Mm. And he had boxes of them. And the day that he went to high school, his mom took all of his comics and threw them away.
Blasphemy.
Because she felt it was time for him to become a grown-up. Mm. And my dad never forgave her. And so when I was a little kid, I was brought Superman comics.
Oh, wow.
From the age of 4 or 5. And they were really my fun with Dick and Jane. You know, they were like how I learned to read. Mm-hmm. It was not C-Spot Run or anything. It was Superman comics.
Right.
And anytime I was sick, Dad would bring home Superman comics. So they were, at a very young age, really, really associated. And when my other friends, who I later met people that were into comics, they were into Marvel comics. Because at the time I grew up, DC comics were fairly bad.
Yeah.
And the Marvel comics were a lot better.
So a lot like right now.
All right.
So I was really, I loved Superman. Like, he was my favorite. He was my hero. So when the movie came out in 78, I was 10 years old. My whole family went and lined up on opening night.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember seeing it. And we have to remind the audience, because we live in today where comic book movies are the most prevalent movies there are.
Yeah.
This is really the first one. There was a kind of Batman movie in the mid-60s, but really, this is, at this point, there are no comic book movies.
Right.
When I was a kid, the teacher would confiscate your comic books. Comic books were treated as a childish thing. Mm-hmm. You were not cool to read comic books. I was beaten up and thrown in a garbage can, and my comic books torn up in front of me when I was a little kid.
Wow.
Like, that's how comic books are treated. So for me to go to a movie and see this thing in a crowded theater was transformative for me. At the time.
Absolutely. And we can't go forward without mentioning the TV series that was in syndication.
I watched it constantly.
Yeah, with George Reeves as Superman. That was what you supplemented your reading the comic books or seeing the strips, because they used to have, I think, little strips in the back.
Yeah, there was in the newspaper. Yeah.
There was an in. So you would see that. And so you'd have that. Then the Christopher Reeve. So the main superhero prevalent in my life growing up was Superman. It wasn't until I hit my teenage years that Batman showed up. And that was in Dark Knight Returns. So I had to go back and discover Batman after that. So,
let's start talking about the film.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, it was a negative pickup, which means that a studio says, "Well, if you guys go make it and raise the money, we'll distribute it." So some outside producers start making it, and they put a lot of money into this movie, particularly for Marlon Brando, who plays Jor-El, gets paid $3.5 million. For 2 weeks' work.
Mm-hmm.
Most money ever paid to an actor at that time. How do you feel about Brando in this movie?
I really just love how he says Kal-El's name.
Kal-El
and Krypton.
Krypton.
Krypton. It's like, that's the thing that always just irks me. You know, I think it's an interesting thing. he's a lot of a lot. It's not how I'd necessarily picture Jor-El.
Yeah.
Yet it's such an iconic performance, and it's so sort of part and parcel with the movie that you can't pull away. I remember when was it the Man of Steel trailer where they kind of quoted the Jor-El? Or like,
yes.
You know, where like, it's like any time, whether it be that or in Superman Returns when it came out, where they kind of put Marlon Brando's face. Like, he's so iconic to the movie franchise that you kind of can't escape that performance that he had.
You will travel far, my little Kal-El. But we will never leave you, even in the face of our death. The richness of our lives shall be yours. All that I have, all that I've learned, everything I feel, all this and more, I bequeath you, my son. You will carry me inside you all the days of your life. You will make my strength your own. See my life through your eyes, as your life will be seen through mine. The son becomes the father, and the father the son.
Yeah, it's really, it's funny because I loved him as a kid. And then at a certain point, as I learned more about Brando and heard that he originally told Richard Donner, the director, that he thought that maybe he should be a floating green donut or bagel that spoke. Rather than him appearing on screen.
I'm just processing that right now.
Now, I've heard the story multiple ways. One version of the story is that's what he really wanted, because he didn't really like to be seen on screen anymore. Brando was an odd guy. And then later, when Richard Donner, I heard him tell the story, he thinks that that was a test, and that Donner had to fight him, and that's where he earned a little bit of Brando's respect.
I wouldn't be surprised. Brando was very much an alpha in that way, very much a mischievous alpha in that way. Would you read his biography, or you watch his... they just had a documentary last year that was released, which was someone had compiled all his personal recordings and voicemails into an hour and 45-minute documentary, and he's the only one narrating the entire thing through his entire career.
I gotta see this.
It's fascinating. And because he had been ahead of the curve and had gotten himself a 3D, he went to a 3D studio and made himself 3D and said, if anyone's going to control my image, I'm going to control my image. I don't want anyone to create me without my approval. So he went to one of these very nascent startups, 3D startups, and had a whole 3D bust and figure made of himself.
Wow.
And that's who they animate at times, saying the words from his recordings and from his voicemails that he left.
That's a lot.
It's fascinating. If you love Marlon Brando, it's certainly a completest thing that you need to watch, because he takes you through it. And Superman, he talks about how much he had looked down on it, how much he had thought it was a childish thing for him to be doing, but they were paying him so much that, you know, it was his way of doing it. But him pushing the boundaries, it makes complete sense. Did the same thing on Moreau, did the same thing at times as he got older in Apocalypse. It wasn't... Godfather was his most humble, and then after that,
I really just wonder, was it a green donut or a green bagel? Because it's very different. It's a very different performance.
Then I'm thinking about it. It was bagel.
And I feel like that's...
Oh, okay. So he's
Jewish. Because it brings in the Jewish thing.
It's just like, it's a really important distinction if we're really going to get into the nitty gritty on it. So
that's a fair point.
I still like his performance as a Brando fan. Still connects. The hair connects. The hair connects
the hair.
To Reeve.
It is some solid hair. It was funny. Rewatching it again, I actually like his performance a lot. Also interesting, by the way, he refused to memorize lines. So he has lines. His dialogue is written on the baby's diaper, on props, on everywhere, so he can just read them at the time. And his explanation was he wanted everything to be fresh.
It's a wonder why anybody thinks actors are crazy folks.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Well, particularly, you know, the bigger you get, the more weird and isolated the world you occupy is.
Yeah. Well, in this thing, just one last reference to this interview, he talks about as he got older, he had trouble memorizing. He was being honest about it. So if you see in the movie The Fury, he is, for no reason at all, he's wearing an earpiece. And it is because someone offset is reading him his lines in the scene. And he is having that pause and then saying the line, having pause and saying the line. And you're like, this is amazing. This is amazing.
Yeah.
You can get away with this.
How about the designs of Krypton?
It's not, that's a really funny thing. It's, you know, as a fan of sort of a lot of the Superman TV shows of recent years, whether it be right. Smallville or Supergirl or anything, that's not the way that I picture Krypton in the comic book universe.
Me either.
But that is so iconic. Those crystals, yeah. the way they look at everything. You know, I mean, Krypton is not the way it's described in the comics, at least. And again, when you say described in the comics, over the years of comics, Krypton has been described any number of ways. But yeah. sort of my comic book reading and the way I picture it is, Krypton was this lush planet that was very alive and vibrant. Mm. And in the movie version, it is this very cold, desolate, sort of crystalline place where everyone's wearing these robes. And it's interesting. And then with Smallville, you know, they really carried that through in the way that they designed the Fortress of Solitude. Mm-hmm. And in Supergirl, right now on CBS, mm-hmm. when she goes to visit Clark's Fortress of Solitude, it's yeah. very much in a similar vein. So it's interesting the way that that's become so iconic, particularly because I think a big thing about Superman in kind of defining who he is, and when you, particularly when you compare the Donner Superman to like Man of Steel, is mm-hmm. the parentage. What is right. what did he learn? What did he get? And what did he take from Krypton versus what did he get from the Kents? And it's yeah. very much a nature versus nurture kind of situation. And you know, Zack Snyder made some pretty big changes in that in his version. Yeah. But I think, you know, what does it say about Superman in the Donner version that he came from this very cold, almost clinical place?
Yeah.
To Earth, and mm-hmm. what does his Krypton heritage mean to him versus what did he get out of growing up on a farm in Kansas? So I yeah. think it's interesting, and I don't know that they actually thought about that all the way through back in 78. I think they were like, let's just make this thing look cool and alien, but it's an interesting thing to sort of ponder.
In fact, they did. So one of the things they talk about, because you're absolutely on the money, is that they basically say the movie has three styles. That style one is this stark, science fiction, cold, unemotional thing. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they took it really seriously in terms of science, doing good science mm-hmm. fiction of mm-hmm. like, we need to invent a completely new way that a world works. And if you watch, I think it's amazing. Mm-hmm. It's pretty astounding that between the design of the Phantom Zone, which is really disturbing, and the big dome and the crystals and all, it's like, wow, this is a, and the glowing clothes, this is a completely unique science fiction world. Mm-hmm. And then you go to Smallville and it's bucolic. Mm-hmm. You know, it's lush and slow and very middle America farm. And then you go to the big city and it is 1940s fast talking, like the style of, there are three styles of dialogue within yep. the film. Mm-hmm. There's three different paces within the film. It is very conscious that they did it that way.
Yeah. My favorite, listen, I enjoy all three, because I enjoy the film, but my favorite parts of the film are when he's a teenager. Those are the ones that resonate with me more. I enjoy the joy of him being Superman, but for me, it just resonates with me more. I love the fact that you have this cold, clinical Krypton that is devoid. You're right, devoid of emotion. It's everything's crystallized. They're all in white robes. You know, the villains are in black. You know, it's literally very black and white. You know, where you have the three villains and they're set into the Phantom Zone, Zod and all them, and then when you get to gets to high school, it becomes almost Norman Rockwell like,
right?
Everything is in this haze of like the good old days and the when people were solid and you had these things. And yes, he had to deal with those high school kids making fun of him, but he also had Lana, you know, who was kind of grabbed to end. But then he had his little moments of fun exploring his powers, running against the train, which is a great little cameo by the original actress who played Lois Lane in the George Reeves mm-hmm. TV show. You see him jump across. I remember. I will forever, that's one of my top 10 favorite scenes of any movie, is him running against the train and jumping past just as it goes by because he's so much joy.
That's so funny because, so for me, yeah. I love the stuff in Smallville. Mm-hmm. I love Krypton. I think it's really cool. But for me, it's once he gets to the city. It's yeah. once he is Clark Kent, once he's at the Daily Planet, because then just starting to see once he's become Superman,
yeah.
it's, and this is like to me the thing that makes Superman Superman is watching the world react to this guy
yeah
who just doesn't make sense in what his abilities are, doesn't make sense in the way he is, doesn't make sense in just being this good guy,
right.
and watching the world sort of react to this and not know what to do about it, like that's where I start to really get super super excited and yeah. get really really into it.
It's funny because one thing I think we have to talk about with this film is the pace. It's really slow. I just have to say it's a slow movie. I really like it, and I love this film. But in terms of the current pace of films, It is slow. And well, so
that's what I was gonna ask you, like, because I whenever I see a movie that was that predates sort of me going to the movies, and this was just edged out, like I was like a year old when it came out, so I didn't see it in theaters. I just chalk that up to every movie was around that slow. Every movie had that kind of pacing. So do you feel like that was slow even for then?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, because if you look at, well, for instance, our last podcast was Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
Touch of Evil ain't slow. That's 20 years earlier than this film. Mm-hmm. Star Wars came out a year before this film.
Good point.
Not slow. It definitely movies sure. were slower. But it, just if you think of, it's a 2.5 hour long movie. You do not see Christopher Reeve until 56 minutes in.
Yeah.
And the at that moment, so the introduction, we've seen Jeff, I forget his name, who plays young Superman, and we see him, and then he goes to the Fortress of Solitude, and then we have the first image of Superman in the suit, Christopher Reeve, and it's on screen for 8 seconds as he does this great flyby, and the camera does not linger on him. We don't get a good glimpse. Mm. And then you withhold him again, and we get to introduce Clark Kent and Lois Lane and Perry White and all these people. And then it's not till an hour and 11 minutes that you have the helicopter scene where we actually get our first Superman moment. Mm-hmm. So we're halfway into the movie, an hour and 11 minutes in before we get Superman. That is a very, very slow pace.
You could argue with this film that it does... But when you look at the segments of the film, and it's great that you say that, Steve, the three parts of the film, it is 1950s science fiction, old school. It is the rock, next step is the Rockwell painting. Next step, it's the 70s, right? It's all, these are all evocative of certain times in American history. And when you watch the film, that's what you're getting downloaded and mainlined into your body before you get to Metropolis. What, to me, the most powerful moment in the film now as I get older is the death of Pa Kent.
Oh, that's great.
Which is played by Cliff Robertson, if I'm correct.
Glenn Ford.
I'm sorry. I always get them mixed up.
Yeah, me too.
Glenn Ford, he has that. And it's a great death. He just says, oh no, that's it. And it's pain. And it hurt. And like, it, I, you know, it just, it now for me, it resonates now as I've lost my dad. That moment is so powerful. And then when he is looking out, I would say after he's been, when he goes out in the morning and he's staring at the sun. That is very reminiscent to what Luke does when he looks at the double suns and Tatooine. And then we get into the comic book of the movie, which is the 70s, and that's so much fun.
Well, and I think, so first of all, Glenn Ford is so good.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a lot of lines.
Nope.
Maybe he has 10, 15 lines. And every one of them is so good. I mean, the moment of, one thing I know, son, is that you are here for a reason.
Yeah, I know. You can do all these amazing things, and sometimes you think that you will just go bust unless you can tell people about it, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, every time I get the football, I can make a touchdown.
That's for sure.
Every time.
Yeah.
I mean, is it showing off and somebody's doing the things he's capable of doing?
No.
Is a bird showing off when it flies?
No. No, now you listen to me. When you first came to us, we thought that people would come and take you away because... when they found out, you know, the things you could do, and it worried us a lot. But then a man gets older and he thinks very differently and things get very clear. And there's one thing I do know, son, and that is you are here for a reason. I don't know whose reason, whatever the reason is, you know, maybe it's because... I don't know. It's, but I do know one thing. It's not to score touchdowns. Huh?
Thanks, Dad.
Yeah.
It sets so much the moral tone of what this character is going to be. And it's interesting because, you know, this obviously is a podcast about classic films, and it's not necessarily talking about more current films, but part of the reason we're doing this is Batman Superman just came out. Mm-hmm. We have Man of Steel. And it's interesting to me to compare Kevin Costner's death to Glenn Ford's death.
Mm.
Because... the idea that I think Hollywood frequently has is for things to be more powerful, they must be bigger.
Hmm.
You know, and that therefore Kevin Costner dies in a tornado in an extremely big scene.
Mm-hmm.
And the Glenn Ford death is so much more moving.
Mm-hmm.
Well, but also, and getting to the core of Superman, I mean, this is one of my big things that I know we've discussed a lot, not on podcasts, but in just real life, as we've been arguing in bars, and I get very impassioned about it.
Sure, sure. I would say discussing.
Aside from that, the smallness of the death versus the bigness and the hurricane, it's also like there's the I know that you're here for a reason versus Man of Steel's you should let people die so nobody finds out about you.
Yep.
Which is... Am I wrong?
I think you're stripping away another element.
No. I think the exact line from Man of Steel is, should I have let those people die?
Maybe. So he's not saying definite.
Well, but I think, we can argue the semantics of it. We can argue the semantics of it all day long. But I think the key difference is that in Superman mythos, yeah, and in this movie, in the Donner movie, his parents inspire him. To your point, like, Krypton is this cold, clinical, scientific, yes, place. Like, that is not the place. He didn't genetically inherit,
you're right,
this amazing moral, like, the whole idea of him being a Boy Scout, yeah, he, yeah, got because he grew up, right, in this Rockwell-esque world, which is what they were going for.
Yeah.
And his father was a source of inspiration who, yeah, said, you're here for a reason. And then, to your point, that drives him on that journey. He goes out, he gets to the city, and he's like, mm-hmm, this is the reason that I'm here. This is what I'm here to do. Mm-hmm. And with Man of Steel, they took that entire thing and said, my dad told me to not do anything. And the movie is him overcoming that and deciding, oh, I guess I should help people. Which is the opposite of, I think, what is important about it and why I love the Donner version so much.
Well, and just to reinforce what you're saying on the Kevin Costner thing is, first he says, should I let those people die? Maybe.
Right.
Then in his death, the whole action of his death is Clark wants to save Dad and Dad says no.
Right.
That reinforces, don't save people. Your secret is more important than my life.
See, I disagree, and I want to be able to finish a sentence here. I want to be able to say this. The reason I disagree is because I think what he's doing is trying to protect his child. He does not know what the world is going to do to him, because this is a different world. This isn't the 1970s world that the Superman we're talking about. This is a different world, and it's a more angry world. It's a more vicious world. It's a more hurtful world. It's a more dangerous world. And I think, and the way I take what Costner is doing, the way they portrayed him, is that he's saying to him, if you get exposed, something could happen to you. I don't know what could happen. I don't want to lose you. And if you come save me, you're going to show your powers to everybody, and they're going to freak out.
You are 100% correct.
That's the way I look at it.
That is what he is saying. But yeah, I think that what you need to get to, and it's everything you just said, is what makes Superman Superman?
Absolutely.
Because, you know, and this extends into that, mm-hmm, very bizarre very bizarre vision quest that Clark has in Batman versus Superman,
yeah,
where the ghost of Kevin Costner shows up and says, if you save the horses in this farm, the horses on the other farm drown, yeah, or something. It was very, I don't quite know
what's
happening.
It's very philosophical.
But there's a constant, your dad is there to remind you that you maybe shouldn't be doing this, that you maybe, right, are making the wrong choices, that even if you help these people, someone else is going to suffer.
Right.
And the point about Superman is, and this is why, as I was saying, I love when he gets to the city in, yeah, the Donner version, because Superman inspires.
Yes.
And I think where these more recent Superman movies are suffering is the common thinking in modern day films, you know, your hero has to be tortured.
Yeah.
Your hero has to be conflicted. Your hero has to not know if he's doing the right thing. And the hard part about Superman is, in my opinion, mm-hmm, and you know, it's subjective, yeah, sure, it's a comic book character, and he's had several different versions over, sure, the years, but he's not conflicted. And he's not conflicted because he grew up on a farm in Kansas in this Norman Rockwell world where his parents told him how special he was.
Right.
And his parents told him that he had a gift. And his parents told him that they might not have the answers, but that if he was true to himself, he would figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
And what he figures out is, this is the guy I am. And when he goes out, you're right, It is a dark, cynical,
yeah,
crazy world. But someone who's inspiring going out into that world is way more interesting than another guy who thinks the world is super bad because his dad told him so, not, mm-hmm, knowing what to do.
Well, and this thing that we have today is, people go, oh, well, he has to be internally conflicted to be interesting.
Mm.
It's like, no, you can have external conflicts.
Right.
You can have, Superman can be faced with extremely difficult choices, but that doesn't mean he's messed up on the inside.
Right.
And I think one of the things that we see, and it's definitely true in Batman and Superman, is that Batman is more flexible in terms of what we will accept and what works for him.
Right.
Because we can have the Adam West Batman, and that can be okay.
Yeah.
And you can have the Frank Miller Batman, and you can have the Tim Burton gothic sort of Batman, and you can have the very practical Batman, and you can have the Lego Batman.
Yeah.
And we're going to go, that's cool.
Right.
Superman is delicate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Superman, there is something, and I think I think what's interesting is that to do the actual Superman character of Christopher Reeve, both in the 70s, which, yeah, the 70s was movies that were all internal conflict, mm-hmm, that character is radical.
Mm-hmm.
It is the conflicted, internal, complicated Superman that we're seeing today that is actually not radical.
Yeah.
Well, and okay. I think what's fascinating, and again, I know that we're not talking about
we got to get back to the modern films,
but I just want to say this because this is an important point, particularly with, you know, Batman versus Superman having just come out and Civil War coming out, and, you know, we do live in the age of superheroes. But one of the things that a lot of people who worked on Man of Steel said, and a lot of people who love Man of Steel and Batman versus Superman are saying, you can't have that hero today. You can't have that hero who's just good and good inside and has conflicts on the outside to deal with. And yet Marvel, with their Captain America movies, has made better Superman movies than the Superman movies we have. Because Captain America in the Marvel Cinematic Universe is a guy who has these classic values and they don't shift, and he believes what he believes, and he is as much a Boy Scout as Superman ever was, and he doesn't bend, even though the world around him is just as screwed up and crazy and weird. And I think that's where they've been more successful. I think that Warner Brothers believes that they can't have that people don't want that. And I think that particularly in the world we live in today, just look at our politics, look at anything going on, look at our, you know, the foreign affairs or anything. I think the world needs the inspiring Superman who knows who he is a lot more than we need a conflicted Superman. And I think that's why the Donner movie, getting back to it, still holds up, as slow as it is and as cheeseball as some of the stuff is. Like, we can get into the Gene Hackman Lex Luthor stuff, which not one of my favorite parts of that movie. But I think that's why it still holds up, because there's something that's just inspiring about Christopher Reeve in that role.
Well, and I think it relates to what people tend to misunderstand about Frank Capra movies, which is that people go, oh yeah, Frank Capra is so corny. Those corny movies. If you look at the world of It's a Wonderful Life or Mr. Smith or Mr. Deeds or Meet John Doe, they are dark, dark, corrupt worlds.
Absolutely.
That you insert a character with classic moral values trying to do the right thing into those worlds. Yeah. And the conflict is between the internal, what we want to be, idealized character within that world. And that is exactly what happens in the Superman movie.
I mean, look, as you said when you introduced me, I spend a lot of time with purple and pink pastel ponies in my life. But, you know, My Little Pony has become a very popular franchise. But I think it's because of this thing. I think that we tend to think that things are corny and cheesy and nobody wants it. But what we've kind of found working on this show and seeing the bronies and everything else that happens is that there's so little of that today. People actually really want something that is just pure and good that they can hold on to and say, this is inspiring. This is something to aspire to be.
Yeah. Yep, absolutely. So let's talk about Christopher Reeve.
Yes.
First of all, they've cast Marlon Brando and Gene Hackman. That allowed them to raise the money. Studio wanted them to have Robert Redford play Superman.
Wow.
Yeah. And Donner very smartly said, well, Robert Redford couldn't do it. But as they're going after other stars of that era, Donner says, no, we need an unknown, because if you put a known actor in that role, it'll be that actor playing Superman. And you need Superman.
Right.
And they had one of the two great casting directors of all time, Lynn Stallmaster, who cast The Graduate and Tootsie and all sorts of fantastic movies. And they did this huge search. And my wife, who is a casting director, would not forgive me if I didn't just say a few words about this. This is a profession that is really disrespected in general in Hollywood. And there are these unbelievable people who find this great actor and become advocates for him. And he pushed Christopher Reeve over and over again, who at the time was like 6'4 and 180 pounds. He was skin and bones. And they said, we don't want to see him. We don't want to see him. He's too skinny. He doesn't look like Superman. He looks like a wimp. And he pushed him. And finally, they get him in the suit, do a screen test. And the moment he does the scene with Lois Lane on the balcony, and the moment he jumps on and says, good evening, Miss Lane, they looked at each other and goes, that's Superman. And he is.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why when you said what you said about the romance, my jaw dropped, because that scene to this day...
What I actually am reacting against is the flying scene.
Okay, we can all agree that flying scene is a little much.
I don't understand. I don't have anything negative to say about this movie. Not one thing. I love Lex Luthor. I love the flying scene and the song that's played, the soft rock song that's played. I love the scene on the balcony.
I love the scene on the balcony.
I love the scene on the balcony. We all love the scene on the balcony.
Good evening, Miss Lane.
Hi.
Oh, I'm sorry. Did you have plans this evening?
Oh, this is the whole thing. No.
Well, listen, it's no trouble at all for you to come back later.
Don't move.
Sure you can move. Just don't fly away, all right?
Sorry to drop in on you like this, Miss Lane, but I've been thinking, you know, there must be a lot of questions about me that people in the world would like to know the answers.
Of course, yes.
You really shouldn't smoke, you know, Miss Lane.
Don't tell me, lung cancer, right?
Well, not yet, thank goodness.
Would you like a glass of wine?
No thanks. I never drink when I fly.
Because once we get into Metropolis, it is a comic book movie, and I take away my mind the fact that it's trying to be a real movie, like a real, like a gritty movie or anything. Everything that it's led up to has, for me, laid the foundation for the movie. So by the time we get to Metropolis, it's let's have fun.
I think the way...
Until the Lois Lane thing happens.
I think the way
the
I feel about Gene Hackman and Ned Beatty in this movie is sort of the way I feel about Cesar Romero or Burgess Meredith
sure.
in the 60s Batman show.
A little bit.
It's not that they're terrible. It's not mm-hmm. that I'm like, this ruined the movie for me.
Right.
But... when I grew up reading comics, and particularly yeah. when I was really into Superman, Lex Luthor was head of LexCorp and running for president right. and was a very a viable villain to Superman.
Right.
And Gene Hackman's performance is very entertaining, and Ned Beatty's great, but it's very cartoony. It's very silly.
Right. It is definitely silly. They're so, really good at it, by the
and
way.
And that's the thing. They're doing it really well.
Yeah, but the whole film is silly once you get to Metropolis.
Because Clark and that's what I'm saying. Like, when, I say I don't love the Gene Hackman stuff, it's not... that's me looking at it from a modern-day comic book fan's eyes.
Yeah, that's fair.
It doesn't take away my enjoyment of the movie.
Right.
But I think that Christopher Reeve is so spot-on as Superman. Mm-hmm. And Mario Kidder will forever be my Lois Lane.
Absolutely.
I think she is the gold standard. Yeah. I mean, we can go through all the Lois Lanes and talk about which ones I liked and which ones I don't, but she is the one by which all the others are measured.
She is great,
yes.
And Gene Hackman is a super awesome Gene Hackman performance,
yes.
but is not my quintessential Lex Luthor.
The West Coast as we know it would
fall into the sea.
Bye-bye, California.
Hello, new West Coast, my West Coast.
Costa del Ex, Lutherville.
Marina del Ex,
Otisburg. Otisburg?
Who's Tess Mosser? She's got her own place, man.
Otisburg?
It's a little bitty place.
Otisburg?
Okay, I just wipe it off. That's all. It's a little town.
You're a dreamer, Lex Luthor. A sick, twisted dreamer. Your plan couldn't possibly work.
I'll admit there were a few problems. Adjusting the precise trajectory of the missile. Finding the optimum stress point for the fault line itself. Which, by the way, is target zero right here.
Ooh.
What's interesting is the Lex Luthor as businessman running for president, that didn't exist.
No,
because that's
all.
Not the Lex Luthor I grew up with.
Right. Mad Scientist was you,
He's
right?
More Mad Scientist.
Yes.
So this was closer to the Lex Luthor, but I love watching him and Ned Beatty
yes.
because they're so good, particularly Ned Beatty.
Ned Beatty's
he is amazing.
The performances are great,
yes.
and even the music, the March of the Villains that John Williams, it's all perfect for what it is.
Yeah.
It's just not, you know,
it feels like it's a different movie.
It does.
It doesn't fit in the movie. I think it's great. Mm. I totally like it, but it seems a little, because they're doing all this effort to take Superman more seriously, not conflicted or gritty or anything, but just not silly comic booky. If you could see the writhing that Roka is doing right now, go ahead.
I know we're not talking about the technical aspects of the movie, so but if we're arguing the movie, like to me, Clark is comical. So therefore,
he's funny.
So therefore, Lex works. Clark is comical. Clark, everything Clark does is ridiculously goofy.
Well, let's all agree, first of all, we're all arguing aspects of a movie that we all three have already admitted we love.
Yes,
so
Nobody's disliking the movie.
That's
right. I'm just saying, I don't think Lex Luthor is out of place because Clark's goofiness keeps Lex Luthor in the movie. They're both equally incorrect in their portrayal of the characters they're portraying. To the essence,
I don't know. I
of
think
the
there's
fact,
a subtle difference.
I don't think Clark Kent's this goofy guy who falls over himself. I think he's a mild mannered reporter. That's what he is, mild mannered. He's not a goofy, clumsy idiot reporter.
Well, here's
but they
where
play
I think,
it that way to juxtapose.
Actually, you know,
Superman in his full form.
Here's where
just
I
like
think
Luthor is played goofy, but when he's mean, when he's vicious, he's vicious.
Is he? When?
Yes.
When is he vicious?
When he's yelling at Tessmacher. When he's trying to get a nuclear warhead. A nuclear warhead. That's nothing a goofy guy does.
Yeah, but it's treated in a isn't this funny that we're doing a comic booky movie way?
Except wait, he has a nuclear warhead that he wants to knock land off of for real estate purposes.
Yeah, but he still wants to destroy families and land and kill people off the coast of California. For Otisburg. Otisburg?
But he's here's what I'll say. I think what's interesting, and maybe it's a perspective thing, and I think it's about the portrayal of Clark Kent that you said that I think is interesting, which is, here's the difference. Christopher Reeve's portrayal of Clark Kent, whether it was goofy or not at the time, and whether it fit who Clark Kent was so defining that even in the comic books, Clark Kent became a little bit more like that over the years. Like, by the time I got to comics, I look at Christopher Reeve's performance, and I go, oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But not because they were making sure it was what the comics were. He is so iconic.
Yeah.
Margot Kidder is so iconic that years and years and years and issues of comics, you know, as particularly as fans of the movie grew up and became writers and artists and everything else, became that. Gene Hackman's performance as Lex Luthor, not iconic, did not inspire people. Lex Luthor went off in his own direction. And I'm not saying I'll get away from right or wrong because we can all have our opinions on it. But I think what's interesting is the things about the Superman movie that became so, like I was saying about the portrayal of the Fortress of Solitude that is now reflected in modern day Superman and Supergirl shows. Like, there's aspects of this movie that became so iconic that they became infused into the comics and are looked at as canon.
Yes.
And there's things that are not. Right. And Lex Luthor's performance in that movie, while a great Gene Hackman performance, and whether or not it fits perfectly in the movie or not, we could discuss all day, did not infuse the world of Superman the way that Margot Kidder and Christopher Reeve did.
But I would absolutely argue that, just like you said about Margot Kidder being Lois Lane, there is no better Luthor than Gene Hackman so far. There is no better Luthor than Gene Hackman. Kevin Spacey did not come close to him, and neither does Jesse Eisenberg.
Well, it's interesting.
I still think he is the best Lex Luthor we've seen on film.
Kevin Spacey's interesting because, just like everything in Superman Returns, you know, that movie is, like it or not like it, Bryan Singer's attempt to just basically give a love letter to Richard Donner. It's basically almost the same movie. And Kevin Spacey's performance, what he's doing is, I'm going to build a bunch of land,
and it's
a real estate scheme. And that is not an accident. Like, they were clearly going for that. So he is sort of like living in Gene Hackman's shadow, not only in his performance, but literally in what his character is portrayed as.
Right.
And then we could spend a whole other podcast on Jesse Eisenberg.
So let's go. Yeah, we'll just stay away from Jesse Eisenberg. Christopher Reeves, both as Clark Kent and Superman, are so great. And one thing I meant to say before when I was talking about the pace of the film, yes, they delay a long time before you see them. Yes, I think it's a little too long. The delay is great because what you're doing is you're building up expectation for Superman.
Yep.
So that when we finally see him, and we get Clark Kent really before we get Superman. And so when you finally see him, there's such a release of all that expectation, and it's done so well. And the character of Clark Kent is so surprising and so funny and so well played. And one of the things that I found interesting watching Christopher Reeve, because he's a young actor, you know, he's so loose. He's so relaxed.
He's so confident.
He doesn't try to do too much, particularly as Superman. He just, this is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
In a straightforward way. It's really impressive.
Yeah. I would say so. I absolutely agree. Like, that's why I don't put it down at all. Like I said, his performance is what keeps Hackman in the film for me. The whole thing in Metropolis is all played as a comic book movie. That's the me. It's a
what
comic
do you mean
book.
By that? What does that
I mean
by
that? It
comic
feels
movie?
Like a comic, an issue of the comic book, a classic issue of the comic, the old school action comics, Superman comics. There's not, everything is played for, not as serious as you think it is. When Lois is getting mugged, he's getting mugged by someone that looks like they just stepped out of Studio 54, and the shot, he catches the bullet, he pretends to faint, which is brilliant. I mean, that's so brilliant. But that's something you'd see in a comic book to try to delude Lois that he's this, like, you know, it reinforces this idea that he's this.
I think you're right.
It goes through the whole thing to the end. It isn't until the end, this is what I'm trying to get to. It isn't until the end that the seriousness, we get the call back to the Clark Kent from Smallville. We get the seriousness that we had the foundation built already from the first two acts of the film, that we have him hold Lois is dead, scream with a ferocity that you did not see coming at all from that Superman.
Among the great primal screams in film,
absolutely.
I think.
But you can't. You don't achieve
along with
that.
Khan.
Oh, Khan is.
I mean, well, obviously.
But you don't achieve that scream without having the foundation of what happens to seeing his dad die in front of him and the pain he has at that cemetery with his mom, and then when he's staring out into the sun. There is a foundation of a man who has suffered and has chosen to do the right thing and be this icon for everyone else. And in that moment, when he loses Lois, he becomes the real Clark Kent from Smallville again.
Well, and I think that's what's interesting. I actually understand what Johnny's saying about it being a comic book movie, because he is right that once you get there, the mugging scene, his whole night on the town where we see him doing his stuff, like, it's all very low stakes. And that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah.
It's so easy for Superman.
Yes.
You know, he kind of like flies through, and this is a breeze for him. He can handle stuff that the cops couldn't handle, that nobody could handle. Right. Even the helicopter scene, which gets a little intense and can be, you know, like, Lois is definitely in peril.
Right.
When he shows up and gets her, like,
it's a joke.
He's good. He's easy. And even Lex Luthor is easy. And it's what's interesting is, and this is why I think, regardless of, yes, it's a nuclear warhead, yes, he's going to go destroy things, that's even treated as not a lot. Because,
absolutely.
Because it's not the threat to America. It's not the threat to the land that pushes Superman over the edge. He actually handles those rockets relatively well.
He does.
It's nothing's hard for him except losing Lois.
Yes.
And I think that's where the heart of this movie comes in. And I think that that's why Lois and Clark are, you know, one of the all-time best. And it's because of these two. It's because of Christopher Reeve and Margot Kidder, because that's the heart of the movie. Like, you're right. It is an interesting thing when you think about it, because it is all pretty low stakes once you get to it. It's fun as hell.
It's fun.
But it's pretty low stakes. And then that happens, and it's just like this shock of reality. And then, you know, he gains a new superpower and spins around the world and turns back time.
For me, the scream that he does here at the end mirrors a scream, and we're not going to get too deep into this, that happens in Man of Steel. When he snaps Zod's neck in Man of Steel and screams, he's screaming for the death of his dad. He is screaming, he's allowing the release that we never saw. And in the scream in 1978, in this Superman, when Lois dies on him, it is the anger and the scream he could not yell when his father died. It is the loss of someone he loves again, this deeply, this close to him, and he lets it all out in this rage.
I could not agree with you more on the Superman Donner version,
yes,
and agree with you less on the Zack Snyder version. It's beautiful.
I think they're
and
done
if,
as
and
a mirror.
If, and I would say that if the people working on Man of Steel had put half as much thought into that as you just did in what you said, I think that movie would be a lot different. Oh, so that's all I'll fair. Say on that front.
Okay. Yeah, I want to go to talk a little bit about Lois.
Yes,
Because I think in a weird way. And this is a thing that's come up before in the podcast, is the damsel in distress is always a thing that these movies struggle with.
The older movies,
Not just the older movies.
Well, sure. Fair.
And I think in a weird way, even though Lois clearly is in distress multiple times in this movie, this movie skirts that issue because her character is so fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And not just that she's tough and a strong woman, but that she is goofy and complicated and flawed and funny and insecure and all of these things, in addition to her tough and brashness, that makes her just go out of that category. And you understand why Clark Superman is so fascinated by her.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think that's what's great. I mean, I think that a lot of times movies fall into this trap of the woman is either going to be sort of just this sort of stock woman who needs to be rescued, or she's going to be the super tough woman who don't fuck with, and she's going to rescue herself, and I don't need a guy to rescue me.
Right.
And guys are allowed to be whatever. You know, guys in movies are allowed to be flawed and crazy and screwed up and have issues. And Lois Lane is a mess in many ways. Mm-hmm. And she's a delightful mess.
Yeah.
Like, she's crazy. And
it's talented
awesome.
And brilliant and stupid and foolhardy.
Yeah.
And again, it's just, she's this person, and you know, it almost is like, it's the opposite. Superman is so cool and calm, and he's got his stuff together, and the silliness of Clark Kent is the facade. Like, he's just this guy, but this woman is just, it's, she's the full package for him.
She doesn't need him. He needs her.
Yep.
Yeah.
100%.
She doesn't need him. And that's what I enjoy about her performance. She's literally the physical embodiment of the word moxie. that entire movie. And again, when I say it's a comic book movie, that last part, it's not a derogatory thing to say about the movie. Sure. I'm not saying that. She's very much the old school screwball comedy. My Girl Friday. She's playing those things. She's playing that part. You know, she ignores Clark. Clark, do this. Yeah, I got to do this. Well, when Clark faints, oh, you fainted. Oh, Clark. You know, there's all these things. Oh, you miss everything. It's just the way she puts him down. It's a very affectionate way that she puts him down, but it's still very much in that vein of the old school, you know, stuff from the 40s, women from the 40s in a lot of these films, 40s, 50s.
And I think the thing you have to remember is that despite all of his powers and all the stuff he knows, Clark's a small town guy.
Yep.
And his mom and the women that he knew and the life that he grew up with are totally different from Lois Lane.
That's why she fascinates him.
That's why she fascinates him. Yeah. She is an endlessly fascinating person.
Yeah, and it's a great portrayal. I mean, it's just a great portrayal from beginning to end. She is so good at being Lois Lane that I don't know if we'll ever see anyone that can really embody that character so well from head to toes.
There's a moment with Christopher Reeve that I just think is such a sign of a good actor, and it's so. What he does in this scene is so complicated, which is it's the moment after he's had the flying scene with Lois. He shows up as Clark and he takes his glasses off and Lois is in the other room and he's making the decision. Maybe I'm going to reveal myself to her.
Right.
And you see him literally grow 3 inches and his whole body changes. Yep. And then you see him shrink and you see the debate happen back and forth. Then him deciding, no, I have to stay Clark.
Yeah.
It's amazing acting.
Agreed. And that's why I enjoy the flying thing, because it's an extension of their interview. To me, it's all connected. The interview is so beautiful. He takes her on the flight because it's an extension of the interview. It's an extension of the growing affection. He's showing her his world. Yeah, you hear that song, you know, can you read my mind? And heard the voiceover, you know, which is a little cheesy, I agree, but...
I'm going to say it's more than a little cheesy.
Fair, but this is the 70s, and they're trying to evoke a Boy Scout Superman. And if you've got a Boy Scout Superman, he's going to be able to break down the modern woman at the time with his charm. And his charm...
Is that what Boy Scouts can do?
Well,
I didn't get that merit badge.
I think a lot of
people... It would have been really useful.
You know, it seems like that's what I got from it. And when he's flying around with her, she's letting her guard down. And she's having these thoughts about him that she has not shown any vulnerability to anyone else in the entire movie.
I think that just gets back to this core thing about Superman.
It gets her more rounder character, too.
You know, whether it's him fighting against a villain, saving a cat in a tree, whatever. But you're right. Like, everything that she represents in her complicated, chain-smoking, thinking that she knows everything, fast-talking, ignoring people, is she represents that modern person in that modern city who doesn't have time for stuff, who actually has grown a little shell around herself, who is a little hardened, who isn't going to let people in, because you know that when you live in the city, you don't let people in.
Yeah.
You can't trust people. And then this Boy Scout comes along, and he's right. Because he's got those, he's absolutely so pure. He's so innocent. He's so good. She doesn't know what to do with it. And him on the other side, he's never seen her. He grew up in Smallville. Everyone was like him. He comes to the city and here's this person who is just complicated and strange. And why are you doing these things that you're doing? And he's so drawn to that. And I think you're right. He needs her.
Yeah.
But she represents the world that needs Superman. Needs that hero that disarms them so much that they're willing to let their guard down.
For all his powers, she's the alpha in the relationship. For all his powers, she's
Alpha. Absolutely.
And I love that. I love that. That's what makes the movie. It's so, in a way, it's so revolutionary for its time, even at 1978.
I just have the love theme from Superman playing over and over in my head right now.
I think with the flying scene, I actually cannot get away from the 10-year-old boy who saw that in the movie theater and went, "Oh, come on, let's get back to the Superman stuff."
It's totally
being the kid from The Princess Bride and wanting to skip the kissing parts, you know? And I think that's always haunted me. Also, one question about it. So, again, I watched it again last night. We have, first he's holding her in his arms, and then they're holding forearms, and then they're holding wrists, and then they're holding hands, and then they're holding just little pinky, and then she slips out.
Yeah.
Does he drop her on purpose?
No, I think he's caught up. In my opinion, I think he's caught up in the moment. It's the first time Superman's experiencing this. Clark Kent's experiencing this. And so I think in the moment...
But he's got to know that, like, she can't fly.
You know, I think when you're young, you make mistakes. I don't know.
I'm going to go with Johnny on this. Like, who knows the real reasons for a lot of things
down
in that moment?
You're okay. It's like a classic. No, oh, I rescued you again. Yeah. See?
I mean, you know,
I don't
there's,
think it's that.
Well, except, you know what? You know where I could argue that it would be is because there is this idea that in this aspect, I mean, here's this guy who can, you know, literally turn back time.
Yeah.
You know, he's faster than a speeding bullet, more powerful than a locomotive. But holding a girl's hand, he's really got a crush on. He maybe
yeah.
and that little kid who does want to impress the girl might actually
let her go
yeah. because he knows maybe. She's not really in danger. He's Superman.
Yeah,
right.
Maybe.
But man, what a baller move! It's a baller
yeah.
move.
Yeah. Yeah,
total.
I got you. I got you, girl. I got you, girl.
Who's got you?
One of the things that's so interesting with this character, and again, it goes back to why this is the essence of Superman to me, is he's polite to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
He's polite to the bad guys. He's polite to Miss Tessmacher.
Yep.
He's polite at every moment.
By the way, on that front, I mean, we'll get to it, but that Miss Tessmacher scene with her, with him and her at the end where she's like, you always tell the truth is one of my... Yeah, it's one of my favorite scenes in the whole movie.
Please, you can't just stand there. You can't just stand there and let innocent people, millions of innocent people die.
Maybe.
Please help me to save them.
If I help you, you promise to save my mother first?
And Laura, sir. Jimmy.
Oh, but my mother comes first. If you promise me, I believe you because you always tell the truth.
Oh, I promise. I promise. Why did you kiss me first?
I didn't think you'd let me later.
Thank you, Miss Tessmacher.
Why is it I can't get it on with the good guys?
Valerie Perrine, what is she doing in this movie? And she makes it work.
It's great.
She has no business being in this movie, and she makes it work. That character works. Every interaction she has with either Luther or with Ned Beatty or with Superman really works.
And again, you go to the character of he gave his word, and therefore that's how he's got to do
yeah.
it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because his word is important.
Right.
And again, I go back to this is the radical character.
Mm-hmm.
That's why we have to have this character today, because he doesn't fit.
Yeah.
And that's why Captain America is so awesome. And Superman right now is not as fully embraced by all of the fan community as some other characters on the screen right now.
Let's not go down that path again. What I was saying is in the Tessmacher scene, what's so great is that he doesn't save himself. He has to rely on, you know what I mean? He has to talk to her and speak his truth and say like, you know, I will save your mom. I promise. I mean, you just got to take this off of me because she'll die.
Die. And but in that way,
that's Luther also being vicious. He doesn't care that Tessmacher's mom.
But in that way, he does save himself. I mean, that's really
the verbally. Yes,
but I mean, you're right. It's the idea that and this is the thing about Superman again is it's not his impenetrable skin and the fact that he can fly as fast as he can and do all the things he can do.
Yeah.
That's not what makes him super. And you're right. Like, that moment nails it. He can do all that. But, you know, you get some kryptonite on him, he's going down.
Yeah.
He does save himself there because of who he is.
You're right.
Because he can be trusted.
Yes.
Because if he says something, he's Superman, and that means it's true.
Right.
And the fact that even the bad guys know that about him, like, that's what really makes him super.
And it correlates to what you said earlier. He inspires her to be better.
Mm-hmm.
Even though she's with the villain, she's done the evil stuff, she's tricked those people to steal the warhead, the military people to steal the warhead, he inspires her. And what's what he's supposed to do? Inspire.
And he doesn't give up on her.
No. Nope.
Part of why he's inspiring is that he doesn't treat anybody, including bad guys, as if they are hopeless.
Yeah.
He treats them as if they're humans who have hope and can do good, and he expects them to do good and changes people around there. It's just what you said, Mike. Yeah. It's by his personality, by who he is as a person, not his powers.
And you see him respecting her as her dad probably taught, as his dad probably taught him to respect women. Like, he does not
call her
a name. He does not talk down to her. He appeals to the angels of her better nature.
Yeah, this argument that we're too cynical today. If you look at the 70s and the films of the 70s, They would have said the same thing then.
Yeah.
In fact, I would say the films of the 70s are in many ways more cynical than the films of today. Films of today become more cartoony.
Yeah.
And to say therefore we cannot afford to have an aspirational character is to me a tremendous mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. We don't have to think he's realistic. We can still aspire to be like him.
Yeah. I think that's what Michael says about Captain America is absolutely true. I think Captain America, if this film, which we're going to see when we're recording this, we're going to see it tonight. If it's as good as everyone says it's going to be, Mike's already seen it. If it's as good as everybody says it is, it may be the greatest trilogy, superhero trilogy, and then can be talked about as one of the best trilogies ever on film, irregardless of genre. And that's because of the inspiration of this character.
But when I think that gets back to, you know, you asked me at the very beginning, like, you know, what was my introduction to Superman, why I like him, and, you know, what you were talking about when you were growing up, teachers taking away comic books, it was looked at as childish. And I think that a lot of times what the people who don't get what's great about this mm-hmm. world of comics and superheroes, they're only looking at the surface. They're like, oh, it's wish fulfillment because you want to have huge muscles, chiseled abs, and you want to be able to like throw a car over your head, or you want to be able to like shoot laser beams out of your eyes. And like, that's all great, but that's mm-hmm. the candy on top. Like
right.
what really makes these characters our modern day myths and heroes are the things that they do that we can aspire to.
Yeah.
I, as much as I would like to, cannot fly. I mean, I've had a few nights at Burning Man where I thought I was flying, but I actually can't do it. But I can be honest, and I right. can treat everybody kindly, and I can do a lot of things that Superman does do
right.
that are actually the things that make him super.
Yeah.
And I think that's where this Donner version, to this day, as slow as it might be, as dated as it might be in some ways, still nails Superman in a way that very few other versions of Superman have.
Right.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
I love the wink in the film too, when we get to this section of Metropolis, like the whole where he looks at the phone booth and doesn't go in there to change the right. Cause it's such a great call to the comics, but also like when he comes out, even I don't know what that black guy was, if he was a pimp or if he was like just
a smooth,
but he's got something going on there, but he steps out and he says, "Dang, look at your outfit," right? And he goes, "Excuse me a second," right? He's not disrespectful. He just does that. And then he takes off and he's like, "Hey, man, look." And it's all played for great laughs. There are 70s. There's a great 70s laughs because it's all played for the moment of what you believe in. Yet, and then he spins down and goes down into the thing. He takes the bullets. He takes the fire. He takes the ice. He walks through all of that without breaking a sweat, without revealing any kind of a feeling of anger about the situation, right? And that's what I enjoy about the film. Throughout the whole thing is that ending, the last part is it's all a great wink to those of us who love the character and grew up with the character. It's a great homage to that character, you know? And when he does, and we should get to this, I think. I mean, this, we should talk about the score at some point, too. I know we're running out of time.
The most amazing score
ever. It really is.
In addition to the Superman theme, which... By the way, I watched this movie with my 5-year-old a couple of days ago.
Mm-hmm.
He was in it 100%, and Superman's big in our family. And we would play the Superman theme on the stereo, and he would wrap his baby blankie around his neck, and we would fly. And I would have one around mine, and we would fly around my house. So that theme is big.
Geek parenting moment.
Right, and what you brought up earlier, the score for the villains is great. All of that is great. And the love theme.
I remember, John Williams several times, once a year, he usually does like a concert at the Bowl where he plays some of his all of his iconic themes. They're all iconic. But one of my favorite moments living in Los Angeles that I can think of was sitting at night at the Hollywood Bowl, just staring up into the stars as he played the love theme from Superman. Mm-hmm. And it was like just a moment. I was just transported. Like it was just one of the most perfect moments of life.
Thank you.
It lifts you.
Absolutely.
It lifts you.
Does it lift you up where we belong?
Oh, no, that's a different movie, but oh, okay. It does lift me up.
I want to go back to something that Mike said before, is I think the idea of Superman is we kind of go, oh, well, he can do anything.
Yeah.
And he's got no internal conflict, so his life must be easy. And that's the mistake, is that, yes, he can do anything. And yes, he has an unbelievably strong moral core and sense of himself, and his life is not easy. Mm-hmm. You watch him as Clark Kent. You watch him in love with Lois Lane and knowing he can't reveal his secret identity. You watch him as Superman having to make these difficult choices, and it's hard.
Yeah.
Even though he can do anything.
Well, and I think that's the trick that most people today don't realize, is that in the world we live in today, being cynical and conflicted is easy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Being a stand-up guy who always does the right thing and has the power to be a crazy dictator but doesn't do it, like doing the right thing all the time, that's way harder than anything that John McClane or anyone else has had to do in movies. I mean, you know, like that's tough.
Yeah.
And it doesn't mean that he's going to have the happiest life. He's not going to get everything that he wants.
I mean, look at Superman 3 and 4.
Good point.
I mean.
John, do you have final thoughts?
Yeah. Well, just we haven't even touched on him turning the world. Like,
yes,
we should touch on that for like a couple of minutes, and then we can. But like, what do you got? I liken it to this neck snapping moment in Man of Steel. I think it was just as controversial back then. The fact that he could turn back time against Jor-El's wishes. And selfishly bring Lois back to life. This is an interesting moment because it's an interesting moment. It's such an interesting moment.
So here's what I'll say, because I love arguing with you about Man of Steel so much. It's a whole other podcast we should have.
Because you know I like it.
just from a structural standpoint,
yeah.
Where I will disagree with you is, we all know that Superman doesn't kill. So when he did snap Zod's neck, that was a big deal.
Right.
That's
even
not,
though he has killed. But yeah, let's keep going.
That is not established in the movie
fair
properly. So when they say, oh, it was this moment because we know he doesn't, like that's something they're taking the audience's assumptions, but not actually putting it into the story. And that's where I have a challenge with just the storytelling. If there had been a, I don't kill in act one.
Yeah.
And then he did the moment. Great. But they didn't. It just happened.
Right.
And so that's where I would argue with that. Now, that's I think fair. What's great about the time, look, the turning back time is an inherently cheesy thing. And here's why it works. It's exactly what you were saying before. Everything else in the movie is low stakes.
Yeah.
He's got everything pretty easy. Jor-El tells him specifically something he cannot do.
Right.
Dad said, don't do this. And again, this gets to the what I learned in Smallville versus what I learned in Krypton.
Right.
Dad from cold clinical sci-fi planet said, here's the rules, kid. You can't do this.
Right.
Mom and Dad in Smallville in Norman Rockwell land told me I was here for a reason. And if you're looking at the movie structurally, nothing else that he does up to that point is really hard. Like, he is there to help everyone.
Except,
he is there to save.
He couldn't save Dad, which I think is directly connected to Lois.
Once again, yeah.
Again, so like that this is where not even arguing with Man of Steel whether they got Superman right or wrong, just from a pure like laying out the movie in the foundation,
right.
He couldn't save Dad.
Right.
And then there's this other person. And to your point from before, which is really great, everything else was so easy. And then this primal scream that we are not expecting comes out. And that's why, even though the whole turning back time is kind of cheesy and doesn't make a whole lot of sense,
right.
You go with it because emotionally, he's like, I'm Superman. And again, that gets to the Superman is going to do anything he can. He will turn back time to help you. Particularly if you're Lois Lane. And I think that's where, as cheesy as it sort of is, and as much of you're like, wait, he did what now? You go with it because it's a beautiful moment and getting back to Margot Kidder. And then when it's all fine and she's good, she's Lois Lane about it. Yeah. What are you even doing here? Let's go. You know, like it's like she doesn't even realize like what had happened. It's awesome.
Yeah.
I personally wish as a movie device that they'd come out with something other than turning back time, because
right.
It is cheesy. I also, the difference with the snapping of the neck to me is that while both turning back time we've heard is against the rules, and we know snapping of the neck is against the rules, there's a big difference between a killing a dude and changing time, which we don't really, it's not really a real thing, to save someone's life.
Right.
They're just different. I do think I think it works for the movie. It's not a thing that I love. It's always been sort of a... Particularly because the more you think about, like, well, wait, what? When did he turn back time to? And what about the other things that happened in the earthquake? And what has happened and what hasn't? Like, Jimmy's still... It's very hard to figure
out. You're right. And it's just from a logic thing. You're kind of like, wait, what now? But it's like I said, like, for me, watching it as a kid and watching it today, because that love between Lois and Clark is something that as the... sappy gay kid watching the movie, I was like, yes, that's what I want in my life. Yeah. So like, even if it doesn't make sense, like the fact that he's like, I'm going to turn back time for you because you are the most important thing and I need you.
Yeah.
You know, I need you so badly in my life. Like, I'm sold. I don't even care. Do whatever. Just that moment just gets me.
Here's the two things I would say. A, I would argue it's the most human moment of him in the film as Superman. It's the most human moment.
100%.
Because a human would do that to save the love of their life. And the second thing I would say about it is I love that, let's not forget that Donner was making one and two at the same time. And the fact that he made the turning back time have a consequence, which released, Zod and the other two, I always forget their names, from the Phantom Zone.
Ursa.
Ursa and Non. Yes. And causes Superman 2 to remember. Right, and causes Superman 2 to happen. So there are ramifications to what he did. And so that to me achieves a validity to the turning back.
When time. I was a kid, I always got very confused as to why they were trapped in an album cover.
It's a really bad 70s
album. Bad 70s album cover. That's for the next podcast, Superman 2. Awesome.
Next week on the Phantom Zone.
On that note, Mike, do you have any final thoughts?
Thank you guys so much for having me. I obviously could talk about Superman and superheroes all day long, so this was a blast, and I really had a great time.
Yeah, thanks for coming on, Michael. My final thoughts are this: if you haven't seen the movie in a long time, and our podcast has motivated you to revisit it, do it. Enjoy it. Tell us your comments. Let us know what you thought. And yes, it's cheeseball. Yes, it's all that jazz. But there's a heart to it that you're not going to find in a lot of superhero movies, and a lot of movies, period.
We definitely would like to hear your comments. You can visit our Facebook page at The Cinephiles. And if you want to give us your opinions on Batman v Superman, we'll address them there.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can reach me at SR Morris on Twitter. You can read my blog at acivilvoice.com. Yes. Roka, where can they meet you?
You can always find me at The Roka Says, R-O-C-H-A. You can see all the shows that I'm hosting or co-hosting like this one, or all the shows I'm a guest on over on the Collider, Schmoes Know, and Screen Junkie Networks.
And Mike, how about you?
You can check me out at MKToon on Twitter, and you can check out some awesome My Little Pony love there.
Some serious My Little Pony action at MK2. All right. Thank you very much. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Cinephiles, and we will see you next time.